Derek Mann with Damon Azali. Welcome to the 4 o'clock hour show, Voices from the Frontline segment on KPFK, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. Today we're going to talk about the state of the black movement, focusing on black voting rights in the South, and what the left, what the progressive movement is doing to ensure the protection of those rights. We're also going to talk about black rights all over the world, from Harlem to Haiti, from South Florida to South Africa. Our guests will be Gihan Pereira and Max Rameau from the Miami Workers Center, who will be on first. And then we're going to have Bill Fletcher, the executive director of the Trans-Africa Forum. And Gihan, Max, you with us?
We are here.
This is Gihan.
And this is Max.
Are you guys, can you hear me, Max?
I can hear you well.
Can you hear me, Gihan?
Yes.
Welcome
Thanks for having us on the show.
How you doing?
Good.
Great.
Doing good.
We're having a little trying to hook on the headphones here.
Hey, hi, guys.
Hey, Eric.
Well, you get the benefit of my opening monologue. So these two brothers have been on the front lines of, this is called Voices from the Front Lines, and they've been on the front lines of work in South Florida and the Miami area. And I just want to do a little bit of framing on how we're thinking about today's show, which is not just the dilemma of black voting rights in the United States, but the dilemma of the black minority in a white settler state, and what rights do people even have. When I was involved with the Congress of Racial Equality in 1964, when I was involved with the whole passage of the Civil Rights Act, I don't think people realize what an amazing thing this was, because you have the classic dilemma, which is the very people who needed the vote couldn't vote, and the very people who had to vote on black rights were primarily white. So you, just like getting rid of slavery, this was not a small thing, it was a tremendously big thing. And to understand why, like in 1948, Harry Truman said the slightest positive thing about civil rights, and Strom Thurmond broke with the Democratic Party and formed the Dixiecrat Party that ran against, basically on a states' rights kind of platform in the South, and did incredibly well, which is why later on, when Trent Lott, as Strom Thurmond was dying, said, "Hey, bro, you did great, and, you know, if we wish you were back in office," why that had such a tremendous impact, because he was saying, "I really wish that there had been a white supremacy party reestablish, otherwise we wouldn't have these problems." So then, when the Democrats did a very courageous thing in 1964 and passed the Civil Rights Act, by 1968, Richard Nixon had come to power, and he ran on a Southern strategy, and he ran by saying that if you vote Republican, I will not enforce the Civil Rights Act. By 1968, the South, which had been solidly Democratic since FDR in the 30s, moved to become Republican, as it is today. It's gotten so bad that the only time that the Democrats have been able to elect anybody since then have been Jimmy Carter, a white Southerner from Georgia, who only got elected because Nixon got caught with his hand in the cookie jar over Watergate, and then the Democrats in 1992, to be absolutely sure, put two white guys from the South on the ticket, Clinton and Gore, two totally backward neo-feudal states of Tennessee and Arkansas, which are, you know, one step above Neanderthal land. And Clinton ran on the issue of, "I will not touch civil rights," even though he was very good appointing black people to office, in fact, appointed more black people to office, which was his civil rights program. But then he kicked black women and Latina women and poor women into the streets with welfare as we know it. So as we fast forward to 2000, the issue was not so much that the five men in the robes stole the election, or that Miami-Dade stole the election. The real issue was that there was a movement of protest. It was led by Jesse Jackson. It was, or at least it was not led by Jesse Jackson. It was led by some of the people who we're going to talk to today, like Gihan and Max. But people like Jesse Jackson came in to give it visibility. And at a certain point, the Democratic Party put a lid on it and said, no, Al Gore said, I don't want to touch voting rights in Florida for this reason. We already have the black vote. We are trying to get the white vote. And if we fight too hard for black rights in the South, we're not going to get reelected. Little did he know, he didn't get elected in the first place, the idiot, and now he's out of politics altogether. So with this introduction to try to frame the perspective of voices from the front lines, we have several questions for the brothers in Miami Workers Center. The first is, what has been the actual change in 2000, between 2000 and 2002? According to the NAACP Miami-Dade newsletter, not very much. But what have been the fights in 2000 around the Voting Rights Act for black people? And what is happening right now in as we get close to this election?
Max, you want to kick it off?
Sure. I think there's two changes which happened. One of them is actually a change, and the other is a movement afoot. First, the big change is that after the 2000 election, large numbers of the population, for whatever reason, not all of them benevolent or anything like that, recognize that there are actually flawed elections in the United States. Elections happen here where there is a winner who is proclaimed, and maybe that winner did not actually get the most votes on the one hand, or maybe that winner got the most votes but only got the most votes because some people were prevented from voting or other kinds of chicanery was used, which would then cause all kinds of electoral problems. So I think people woke up to the fact that there are not always legitimate elections in the United States. As a result, in 2002, for the 2002 election, non-presidential election, in Miami-Dade County, a group of us, which was spearheaded by the Miami Workers Center, and also heavily participated by the NAACP, got together and demanded that we have independent election observers for elections in Miami-Dade County. This is big because we traditionally think about having election observers in other countries, like third world countries. You think about Haiti or Jamaica or South Africa or anywhere else but the United States, anywhere else but Europe and the United States, where they have election observers who go there and they say, okay, your elections were legitimate or your elections were not legitimate and we're not recognizing them. So we actually had that in a sanctioned way in Miami-Dade County in 2002, which was the first time that happened in U.S. history, that there were outside observers who were sanctioned to come in and then give an official report on the status of the election. This was a huge, huge leap, and I think it will have implications throughout, and I hope we spend some time discussing the importance of that. Second part, which was not an actual change but was a movement, is for the first time a large number of people, particularly in the Democratic Party, started to care about an issue that many of us here have been screaming about since Reconstruction, but really in a real organized way since 1996 in Miami. And that is, in the state of Florida, if you are convicted of a felony, and not just convicted of felony in the state of Florida, if you're in California, New York, or anywhere else, and you're convicted of felony, and then you move to Florida, you lose your right to vote forever. And the only way you can get your right to vote back is to petition the governor, in this case, Jeb Bush, and Jeb Bush will either give you or not give you your right to vote again. Yet in the meantime, of course, you're still paying taxes. So this is really, really, you know, very real concrete way, taxation without representation. So what happened in the 2000 presidential election is that Jeb Bush's office, through Catherine Harris, the famous secretary, now famous Secretary of State, went on a move to enforce in a way more aggressive than ever before the law that ex-offenders could not vote. So they went about purging the voter rolls from anyone who either was an ex-offender or looked like they may have been an ex-offender. And what they did is they had a company write a computer program to purge anyone who was an ex-offender from the law, but they wrote what they call loose rules, which means if my name is Joe Smith and I was a convicted felon, they had my name in the database. But also the way they set up the thing, if anyone was named Joe Smithers, not just Smith, but Smithers, Joe Smithers would have also been removed from their voting rolls, and that happened to a lot of people. So a lot of people who were ex-offenders and who did get their rights back to vote, and a lot of people who were not ex-offenders but whose names were similar to those of ex-offenders, or no relation to them, but names were similar, did not get the right to vote. And so the Democratic Party, for the first time since Reconstruction, realized that, hey, we might have won an election if we only would give ex-felons the right to vote. And they have taken that up as an issue now that they are out of power in Tallahassee, which is the state capital, but they really have not taken that issue seriously since Reconstruction. There have been people complaining about it since then.
And what I would add is, I think, I mean, part of what the reality is, and I would say in most southern states, and particularly in Florida, is that the reality is that on a large scale, black folks' votes don't count. And what happened in the aftermath of 2000 was that that became readily apparent to the rest of the world. And I think what happened as a result of that was that, one, you know, with all the attention that came to it, the most significant thing that happened was that there was a real grassroots effort to address the election system. Part of that grassroots effort was the effort that we and others in South Florida did to say, look, we cannot count on democracy in the United States to be any more legitimate than suspect democracies anywhere in the world. And a matter of fact, there's a legacy here in the United States that we should be even more suspect, particularly of democracy in southern states and around black folks. And we need to not just give American democracy a pass. And we need to hold it to the highest standards. We need to observe it, monitor it, and deem it what it is. And if that's invalid, then we need to say that the democracy in the United States is invalid. And moving towards getting independent observers for us, international independent observers, both called into question American democracy, but then also said, look, that particularly for black folks, you can't count on the apparatus of the state, particularly the state in Florida, to guarantee your rights.
Given that, Gihan?
Yeah.
But so just to take you where you want to, where we hope you go with this,
mm-hmm.
So how does that translate into movement building now?
Well, I think two things. I think one is that the exposure within the black community of the robbery really made stark clear what the reality of you know, that we're not in much of a different place from 1964 before, particularly in Florida and the South, than we were then in terms of rights. And so I think there's a permanent, since 2000 within the black community, a permanent consciousness around that. Number two, and just getting to something that you said, we had heard that that there was going to be tons of infrastructure built to actually, you know, to not allow 2000 to happen again. And in fact, the infrastructure of that has not been built yet, except through grassroots efforts, through groups like the ACLU, and some other groups who are just starting to do some level of voter protection again. It's only the Democratic Party that we've seen in our neighbors hasn't been there in black communities to, you know, to really put the infrastructure in place as of yet to make it happen again. And so what it means is that organizations like ours, other community-based organizations, people who understand what's at stake, have really been stepping up to say that, you know, this isn't something we have to take for granted, that we have to be able to take measures to take our rights back. And so this year, you know, the main thing that we're working on is to actually bring back in independent observers and actually say that there needs to be potentially an entire southern strategy to bring in international independent observers to monitor the U.S. elections in November.
We're with Gihan Pereira, Max Ormo from the Miami Workers Center. You're on KPFK 90.7 FM. Eric Mann, Damon Azali on the Voices from the Frontline 4 o'clock hour. One of the questions is that, Gihan, when you and I were talking prior to the show, one of the things that you let us know is that the Democratic Party tactical plan seems to be, let's turn out the vote, number one. Let's not talk about racism as much. Let's talk about George Bush. And because most black people don't need a lot of information, they want to vote no on Bush, even more on Kerry. But the dilemma seems to be that in reading some of these press releases we got from the NAACP, in the last election, it says on primary day in September, I assume 2000, the result was a disaster. Cutting-edge technology fell victim to inadequate support. Many did not get to vote. There were people with long waiting lines in front of primary stations. There were computer programs that didn't work. So is that true, and what's going on now?
Well, I mean, yes, it's true, and I think people are preparing for a mess. I mean, I think one of the things that happened as a result of 2000, and Max can comment on this as well, is that, you know, basically they tried to take a technological fix to a political problem. So, you know, basically the major change from 2000 was that they introduced touchscreen electronic voting throughout the state, and that touchscreen electronic voting has tons of problems with it, the least of which is technical. There's no paper ballot to prove that you actually voted for who you're voting for. And so this huge, you know, that actually has caused even greater suspect and suspicion amongst Florida voters than the previous voting system. And there are efforts now to try and put a paper ballot onto this, on the electronic voting machines, and other efforts to try and, you know, further ensure what's happening. But from our view, this could potentially be even a greater threat to in terms of potential problems than we had before.
So I have a question in terms of the kind of prisoner rights groups. It seems to me like most of the ex-prisoners groups would be more progressive, more left on the issue of actual voting. So I wanted to talk a little bit about that. And then also, just to kind of mark coming up, in 2007 there's going to be the renewal, hopefully, of the Voting Rights Act, in which, you know, a lot of times people have been saying how basically black folks are going to lose the right to vote. And what actually is going to happen is some of the provisions that actually protect the rights of black folks to vote are going to expire. So what that basically looks like, if a lot of the states that are in the South that have had historically have had really poor practice in terms of allowing folks to vote, they have to actually go to a federal panel to see basically if they want to change any of the laws or rules or whatnot in terms of redistricting stuff around, you know, in the back in the day around poll tax and whatnot. So just wanted to see if there was also any links that folks are actually making toward the restoration, not the restoration, but the renewing of also the Voting Rights Act.
We've been spending a lot of time talking about the restoration of rights, and in fact, we in particular have been saying that people shouldn't lose their rights at all. There are two states in the United States where people who are actually incarcerated can vote, and there are several countries around the world where that is so. And so we think as long as you're counted in the census and as long as you have to pay taxes, both of which are true for Christians in the United States, then you should be able to vote. So, but that's another issue. So even right to registration, but all of that has been perceived and envisioned through the historic lens of the disenfranchisement of blacks in the United States. So this was the whole thing of losing your right to vote once you get convicted is actually a Reconstruction era law. So when blacks were found loitering, and you would basically be loitering because you're looking for a job, and you don't have a job, then you could be arrested for loitering, and then you would automatically lose your right to vote for the rest of your life, unless the governor was politically dumb enough to give you your right to vote back. So that was the tool, and people generally see the connection between the two, between historic, you know, versions of keeping blacks to vote, such as the poll tax and other things, and this particular tool, which is denying people who were convicted of a felony the right to vote. So, yeah, there is that connection, and then tying that, although we haven't had specific discussions yet about the Voting Rights Act this time around, there are discussions and clear linkages between us having protection of our voting rights and us actually having voting rights. So people who say that we're going to lose our right to vote after this thing, you know, even though technically that may not be correct, it's hard to argue with that given the history of how our rights have been taken from us historically here.
And, you know, Max, previous to working at the Worker Center, also worked, you know, with an organization of ex-offenders called Brothers of the Same Mind here. And it's true. I mean, the organizations and the ex-offenders organizations are clearly on the, you know, progressive and left side trying to make this happen and see the history of race and racism and currently the direct correlation between racism and incarceration of particularly black men in the state. As directly tied to political power, and you know, in our neighborhoods that we're working in, that's huge because it means that it's a large percentage of people who are officially in the African American community that are officially unable to vote. And I think what you said about in terms of the reauthorization of the Voting Rights Act, I think. It gets back to some of what Eric had said earlier is, you know, what happens if on all of these key issues, if Kerry gets a pass, because of the total unanimity around being against Bush, what's happening is now I think that Kerry's record, his commitment to any kind of civil rights, discussion or rights for black folks is basically being unscrutinized, you know, is not being held to any type of scrutiny. And he's not being held to any commitments towards that. And I think that's probably the greatest danger in currently what's happening in the election.
Right. And then I guess the last question I have for you guys is that, and you guys, is Max Rameau and Gihan Pereira with the Miami Workers Center, is the role of the Cuban-American community, or as some people call at least the right wing of it, Gusanos, former Cubans, Gusanos, Worm, and Mexican, I believe. But in, for instance, one of the Cuban-American commissioners commented about human rights observers coming to Miami-Dade. This was Natasha Sejas.
Seja.
How's it pronounced?
Seja.
It says, if they're coming here for human rights, then I have a few suggestions for them about human rights that would blow their heads off. Very subtle. So what's it like trying to build multiracial unity in Miami on the ground with such a strong right-wing Cuban community? Are there, obviously there are progressive Latinos, that's not even a question. The question is, can the progressive Latino community find room to breathe? Or can anybody find room to breathe in Miami under the kind of Jeb Bush, right-wing Cuban United Front going on there? What's it like trying to do that work on the ground?
Yeah, it is not easy to say the least. However, to be fair, I must say that we've won a lot of political space in the past 6 or 7 years. The stuff that we're doing now around even election, straight election reform, would not have been possible 6, 7, 8, 9 years ago. But now it's possible because of a political space that the left has been able to win through, you know, through very hard-fought fights. So it has not been easy. And when we had the vote for independent observers come here, it was clear the vote was going to go our way, and there were Cuban commissioners on the dais, and they, when they recognized the number came up, they all, in unison, without saying a word to each other, stood up at the same time and walked out of the room, which denied the commission a quorum, which means they couldn't vote on it during that particular session. So we ran dangerously close of not having independent observers, not because the majority of the people in the county didn't want it, or even the majority of the commissioners didn't want it, but because right-wing Cubans stood up and walked out rather than take a vote that they were not pleased with. So it's extremely difficult both in terms of political pressure and in terms of just tactics that they're willing to use in order to avoid going down a progressive route.
And I would add, you know, I grew up in L.A. and then went to school and did politics in the Bay Area. So, you know, to be in Miami is far opposite of progressive in terms of the atmosphere environment you can imagine. It's a completely different ball game, and it's potentially the politically most difficult terrain you can imagine for, being progressive. But I think what's actually, in a weird way, in our favor is the material reality of the city, which is that with all the ideological right-wingness, part of the result of that is that Miami was also the poorest city, according to the 2000 census. We're the poorest metropolitan city in the entire United States. We're also home to the richest municipality, which is about 10 minutes away from the poorest city. And so that material reality of poverty and the low wages really can't be escaped in terms of really organizing around issues that are real to low-wage workers, that are real to black folks, that are real to people of color. And, you know, we have to end up being a combination of really strategic and really pragmatic in really being able to move an agenda towards a progressive direction. And I agree with Max. I think over the last 6 to 7 years, that the organizing, the progressive organizing in Miami, you know, not only with us, but with us, unions, with a number of other community-based organizations, with organizations around gay and lesbian rights, has all really picked up, and I would say probably doubled and tripled just in the last 6 to 7 years.
Well, it's real good that we have groups like the Miami Workers Center, because, as you know, Gihan, all the objective contradictions between rich and poor can go on forever and not necessarily lead to anything progressive. What's progressive is sending organizers on the ground, training organizers, building these movements, and trying to figure out how to negotiate as you live in a semi-feudal, semi-fascist country called Miami-Dade. So very happy to have you on the show, and props to the excellent work that you do, and we'll keep you in mind for other Voices from the Frontline segments as the election gets closer.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks so much. Good to have you all. Good talking to everybody.
Thank you.
All right. And so we'll be right back with Bill Fletcher on Voices from the Frontlines.